Okay, good morning, welcome. We hope that your morning is going well so far. Before we begin, I'd like to just point out the letters and the numbers for those of you who are keeping track for continuing education credits. The sign-in number is 3 on the back wall, and the sign-out letter is D on the front wall. Also, if you need any assistance during the lecture, please do not hesitate to call on me. I'm Marion and Kelly at the back door. We're your room volunteers. For those individuals who are earning CEU credits, please look through your CEU evaluation form and fill it in at the close of the session. We're so grateful to TIC, the Talking Information Center Network, who is recording some of our sessions, including this session today. Please know that a voice recording of this session and a copy of the PowerPoint will be available on the Focus website in the Focus Conference Archives. The web address can be found on the black and white business card on your yellow folder, Focus on Vision and visionloss.org. We're grateful to Dr. Hyderi for sharing her work in this way with us for your continued learning. It's now my pleasure to formally introduce Jenna Hyderi, MD, PhD, Assistant Professor of Ophthalmology from Harvard Medical School and Director, Pediatric Neuro-Ophthalmology Service at Children's Hospital. Dr. Hyderi will be presenting cortical visual impairment, the role of the ophthalmologist. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Hyderi.
Thank you so much for that sweet welcome. And it's really an honor for me to be here. So just sort of housekeeping, can you hear me? Because we're not sure if the mic is on.
Yes.
And maybe we can have the mic a little bit dim. And is it okay? So I think I'm going to sit because we're working with this laptop, but let me know if I should stand if it's easier to see me. So I'm the director of the Neuro-Ophthalmology Service at Boston Children's Hospital and a pediatric ophthalmologist at Boston Children's Hospital. And the purpose of my talk this morning is really to describe the role that we think we play in this kind of collaborative approach towards managing our children with CVI, cerebral visual impairment or cortical visual impairment. And I see friends in the audience and some of you I don't know yet, and I hope to collaborate with you. I think the primary role of the ophthalmologist and all of us in this community is to get educated on the topic. So this is not a topic that's formally taught during ophthalmology residency. I did a fellowship in pediatric ophthalmology as well as neuro-ophthalmology, where you might have thought we would have formally covered this topic. And in truth, it really isn't part of our formal education. So much of what I've begun to learn about CVI has come through my experience seeing children with CVI in my 10 years at Boston Children's Hospital. So there may be things that insights I don't yet have, and I welcome your feedback and questions at the end of the talk. We also had a wonderful talk from Dr. Marabet this morning, and some of the data that I'll be showing you today is a reflection of collaborations with Dr. Marabet. So I think we can go more granular on CVI and talk about it together, and again, talk about how we can collaborate together to help our children. So the first thing I like to do is just look at a visual scene. And maybe Dr. Kapan, if you can describe what it is that you see here.
People playing musical instruments with illuminated bows.
Okay, great. And so Dr. Kapan is describing, so in the scene, she notices that there's a group of children playing an instrument. He's interpreted that they're using illuminated bows, and but there's a lot going on, right? So you have to make a number of different interpretations and leaps in order to make this. You have to recognize that there's a group of people, that these are children, recognize the object, that these are violins. Try to interpret, usually a violin has a bow, but the bow doesn't have a light on it. Why is there a light on it? Who is this person in the foreground? What is happening here? And so we're trying to talk about a condition in which the perception, the mapping of this scene, the integration of all this visual information is difficult for children to, for them to do. Some children may be fascinated by the person in the foreground. Some children, this whole visual clutter may be so difficult to process that they can't really interpret what is happening. Some children may be fascinated by the motion of the lights moving back and forth. So they say, well, I see lights moving, but they can't interpret that these are lights affixed to a bow. So this is what we'd like to talk about. How can we better understand our children who have difficulty processing all this visual information, and how may we habilitate them to do better in their educational environments? So what is the visual brain? You know, again, Dr. Maribeth's here, and he's already given us a great lecture on this topic, but from an ophthalmologist's point of view, we talk about, you know, the eyes capture this visual information and transmit it to the visual cortex. This information is processed. And then that interpretation informs how we recognize elements of the scene, Dr. Cran recognized that these were violins and these were bows. And then we are interested. We might say, you know, I'm looking for my child in this scene. So we have to have visually guided movements of our body, visually guided movements of our eyes to attend to different items of interest in the scene. And then we might do something because of that. So we might say, okay, well, there's our child over there in the back. I'm going to videotape him playing his violin. But we have to, there's a lot of processing that occurs. And this interpretation of the scene has to be continuously updated. So our brain is continuously processing this information. It's looking around the room. It's mapping the room. It's interpreting what's coming in and then making specific decisions about what to do with our bodies and our eyes based on that information. So this idea of cerebral or cortical visual impairment is a visual impairment that can't be attributed just to pathology within the eye. And we think that this type of visual impairment may occur from injury to the visual pathways that are involving the optic radiations, the visual cortex, and then areas of higher order visual association centers. And it's important to recognize that some children may have both. So these are not necessarily distinct phenomena. There are children who have ocular impairment, they have optic nerve atrophy, they have injury within the eye, they have need for glasses, but they also have difficulties with visual processing. And this diagnosis is not one that the ophthalmologist can make. So increasingly, children come to my practice and families have asked, you know, we understand that you can make this diagnosis of CDI for us. And the truth is, it's not really something that I alone can interpret and make. It's true that in our state, in order to get services, support from an ophthalmologist is helpful. It's necessary to get the kind of support and services. But I really see this as a collaborative issue that I need to have input from teachers for vision, from early intervention specialists, from educators, from behavioral optometrists, from developmental optometrists, really our entire community, neurologists, to collectively come to a conclusion that cerebral visual impairment is present. So Dr. Maribeth talked a little bit about the epidemiology of CDI. It's the leading cause of significant visual impairment in children of developed countries. And we talked about some of the reasons why this might be the case, that increasingly we have children who are surviving prematurity, and so they survive sort of the morbidity of the early phases of being in the neonatal ICU, but then later have other consequences. They may have visual impairment or CDI. In one UK population-based study of children with profound visual impairment, they found close to half of the children had CDI. But it's one of these things that even though it's the leading cause of significant visual impairment, again, I emphasize that it isn't taught to us in ophthalmology residency. And so part of our goal as educators and clinicians is to try to educate our different communities that this indeed exists, because that recognition is the first step towards trying to develop a program to help these children. So the causes of CDI vary. So the classic, etiology associated with CDI is early injury to the visual pathways, either from an injury in utero or from an injury right at the time of birth where there's decreased oxygen supply to the brain. But there are there are causes that can cause injury to the visual pathways after birth, a head injury or trauma, children who develop early, infection of the in their early infancy, some children who have malformations of the brain. A group of children whom I see have no early onset injury, but they may have genetic conditions that predispose them to have difficulty with visual processing. They may have neurodegenerative conditions that that we would characterize their visual difficulties as CDI. So it's important to recognize that even though there may not be sort of an obvious perinatal insult, there are a number of reasons why children may have difficulty with visual processing and need to explore that. So the issue that I think comes up quite often is that children with visual impairment may also have other comorbidities that make that shift our focus away from the vision issue, and it shouldn't happen this way. So some of our children may have developmental delay or cognitive delay. Some of our children, we can't focus on vision because they have seizures that are uncontrolled. Some of our children have motor deficits. Some of our children have hearing deficits. And so, again, it's important for us to attend to the child holistically and recognize that vision is so important to the quality of everyday life that we have to pay special attention to it, but it's important to know that it's existing in kind of this larger context so that vision is not just the only aspect that we need to rehabilitate. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how vision develops normally and what is distinct about the visual development in CDI. So this graph shows, let me step back and say, in general, when we're born, our vision is immature. We're actually all born legally blind. And our vision doesn't mature to our what we consider 20/20 perfect visual acuity until we're about 5 or 6 years old. So the reason for this is that the nerve that communicates vision information from the eye to the brain, the optic nerve, isn't fully mature. The 20/20 seeing part of the eye that we call the fovea is not fully mature. So this maturation has to occur in the early phases of life in order for us to see with this fine 20/20 acuity that we are accustomed to. But here, if you look at this chart, this is 0 months of age up to 48 months, so 4 years of age. And you see, this graph basically shows kind of in the first year of life, there's a great deal of progress in terms of visual maturation, and then slowly vision continues to mature until we reach that 5 or 6 year old point. This graph was from work done by Louisa Mayer doing a test called preferential looking that we use to quantify vision in children who are preverbal and unable to do recognition acuity. So Dr. Fulton, Ann Fulton, and her colleagues at Boston Children's Hospital looked at children with profound neurologic history with hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy who were profoundly impaired, they had seizures, and a diagnosis of CDI. And so we can see she looked at vision in two separate ways, by the preferential looking cards and by visual evoked potentials, which is a different way of quantifying vision. And the take-home message from these is that if we look at the top, so the dotted lines show kind of that normal curve of visual development, and all these jagged lines with the triangles are children with CDI. So children with CDI in this group tended to have vision that was subnormal for their age. So they didn't reach those normal milestones of visual development. And similarly, when we looked at vision by the EP, and these are all the children with CDI, they're well below sort of the normal range of visual development. So we think that our children with CDI, in some cases, our children with CDI don't end up with the same level of visual function, visual acuity, as their sort of normal developing controls. But as Dr. Maribet mentioned, there are children with CDI who have perfect visual acuity, who have 20/20 vision. And in some ways, these are the children who are hardest to identify, because often in schools, it's difficult to communicate to educators that we know the child can see 20/20, but in their environment, it's very difficult to see. It, you know, the functional vision versus vision function, as Dr. Maribet had suggested. So in this group, it's easier to see that these children are profoundly affected in terms of their vision because they have other neurologic deficits and seizures and sort of more global issues that made educators more aware of their CDI. So similarly, Dr. Fulton looked at are there measures that we as ophthalmologists can look at in the office that may help us to identify children with CDI? Because I think this is the hardest thing for us, you know, is there a diagnostic test? Is there a test for CDI that a child can come in the clinic and say, okay, I do this test, and yes, you have CDI, and then help get services? No, there's not a test. So we look for ways that we might help to better identify our children with CDI. So in this graph, I'll just describe it. Basically, they were looking at this VEP and PLT measurement. And normally, the VEP and PLT go together really separated by one octave of vision. And in children with CDI, the separation between VEP and PLT is much larger. And I only highlight this because this may be a way for us as we go forward to say, okay, well, how may we begin as ophthalmologists to identify our children with CDI? May we use this visual measure of comparing PLT and VEP to say, okay, well, you know, if there's more discrepancy between these two, maybe these children are more vulnerable to CDI. So it's something that we as ophthalmologists may be using just to help identify these children. Because right now we don't really necessarily have specific tool as ophthalmologists to identify these children. And I think that's what makes it most difficult to diagnose. So what other things may be affected in CDI that as ophthalmologists we may identify? So children with CDI may have visual field loss. So we know that one of the behavioral characteristics of CDI is that one characteristic that may be present is that children have difficulty accessing their inferior visual field. So parents may say, you know, she never looks down. She trips over things all the time. I feel like she can't even see what's in front of her on the ground. So what we need to do, at least in some of our children, is formal visual field testing, because in some cases, actually the visual field is gone. So there are sort of two aspects. In some, there's difficulty accessing this visual field, but the visual field is intact. But in some, the visual field actually has been lost because the specific pathways that give this visual field have been injured. So this is just an example of how the lower half of the visual field is completely absent in this child. So in this child, if you didn't test visual field, you may say, you know, what's happening? Why can't they read? Well, they may not be able to read because materials are actually presented here in the area of their visual field where they can't see. So it's so important as ophthalmologists that we formally test this whenever we're able to help educators recognize if there's actual field loss. So the other thing that I look at as a pediatric ophthalmologist is the presence of eye movement issues associated with CDI. So it's been described that up to 3/4 of children who come into the ophthalmology practice may have eye misalignment or strabismus. In the overall population, the percent of strabismus or eye misalignment in the general population of kids is about 3-5%. So in some studies of children, it's much higher. And you know, the impact of eye misalignment on visual function can be a change in the quality of our ability to perceive depth. So we need to have our eyes to be straight in order for us to have depth perception. And so when we have underlying misalignment, that impacts our ability to judge depth. And we parents may say, you know, it's difficult for the child to navigate going downstairs. child may have difficulty making the transition from carpet to wood because they're not sure if it's a step down or if it's flat or going down curves. So as an ophthalmologist, it's important for me to try to address this so that we can improve the quality of the vision that the child has to work with. Some children have a to and fro movement of the eyes called nystagmus. And some children have difficulty with sort of tracking or eye movement that we call saccades. Dr. Maribeth talked about this in his talk beautifully, and I'll just reiterate a little bit of what he described. So the first part of what I'm talking about is, you know, what are some of the details as an ophthalmologist that I can recognize in the clinic that may contribute to our understanding of CVI? So I measure the vision, the visual acuity. I can make a comment about the peripheral vision. I can make a comment about the eye movement and the eye function and the eye alignment. But then in the office, we are not really equipped to begin to investigate these elements of functional vision that some of my colleagues here in the audience do. So our teachers for vision, our behavioral optometrists, our educators are then in educational environment or a different clinical environment now assessing some of the behavioral characteristics of CVI than in the eye clinic we don't evaluate. So these characteristics are associated with then the association center. So we have the visual cortex. So vision comes in and I'm really evaluating how does vision come in? What can we measure of this? But then this vision is processed. So vision then is connected to the posterior parietal lobe, where Dr. Maribeth was talking about this dorsal stream or the where information. That information is gave Dr. Khan the ability to sample the scene we saw in the beginning, to say, you know, I can interpret what's happening and I can kind of update this map of the children in the scene, the teacher moving, and what's happening. And then the ventral stream is sort of associated with what? What is it? That's a violin, or that's a bow, or that's my mom's face. So these are sort of separate areas that are important in interpretation of this information. And in CVI, we believe that CVI impacts this visual processing in a number of ways. So the dorsal stream dysfunction leads to difficulty with visual complexity. So this is the distractibility testing that Dr. Maribeth is doing, that as he increased the complexity of the scene, children with CVI had more difficulty doing the task. The dorsal stream is also involved in visual attention. So, you know, I want to pick out my child in this scene of kids playing violin, and somebody with CVI may have difficulties attending to what's happening because there's so many other distractors, both visual, auditory, and then difficulties with visual motor planning. So a child with CVI may say, you know, I know that this is my mother over here, but how do I get there? How do I move my eyes to do what I need to do? How do I guide my body to move where I need to move? And then ventral stream dysfunction is more the what, difficulty recognizing the object of interest, and difficulty with visual memory. So it may be that, you know, when we're copying something from a board, there's a lot that has to happen. So we have to memorize basically what's on the whiteboard, and then we have to write it down. But imagine a scenario where that recognition, that memory, that mapping of what we needed to write down kind of goes away, and then we're not able to copy down what the teacher says on the board. I mean, there's so much that has to happen that we shouldn't take for granted that may be so difficult in a child with CVI. So some of the behavioral characteristics that parents can describe include gazing at lights, avoidance of gaze, not making eye contact, children using their peripheral vision to locate an object. So, you know, parents may say, my baby doesn't really look for the mobile, may look with their side vision at objects. We talk about an increased latency of the visual response, so that there may be a time delay where a child is able to recognize what they're looking at. This difficulty with visual complexity cannot be understated because it really impacts everything. It impacts how a child navigates his or her environment. It may even impact how a child interprets materials presented to them on, you know, on a piece of paper. So I give the example of, you know, for example, you have a math worksheet and it has 20 problems on the math worksheet. Trying to sort through all these problems may be quite difficult, but if you isolate one single problem and cover everything else up, it's much easier to access that visual information because there isn't sort of this visual jumble that's happening. And so how, as educators and clinicians, can we educate our teachers to understand that? Even if the vision is 20/20, you know, because it's, again, this is this disparity that you could have excellent vision. You could be able to see all the 20 problems on the page, but the complexity of what's presented to you may make it difficult to process. And there's this variability of visual attention. There may be times where children are quite on in terms of their visual attention and their engagement in visual tasks, and then there may be times where vision seems like it's off. This is what parents describe. And that visual attention may get sidelined by other aspects of their medical history. So when they're having seizures that are uncontrolled, this really distracts from their ability to process visual information. So from my point of view, the ophthalmology assessment is really a very small part of what's necessary to better understand a child with CDI. It's an important part. It's important for us to document, you know, what is visual acuity, to assess visual fields, to determine if there's any ocular motor dysfunction that I can improve to try to improve the ability to access the scene. But I think there's so many additional elements that are critical in order to really establish what's the best educational plan for this child. So I always often call upon my colleagues at Perkins and in our community to have our children get a functional vision assessment. I think children benefit from a low vision assessment, which we can do at Boston Children's Hospital. I think it's critical to have our TBIs involved as soon as it's possible. And, you know, we're really rich in Massachusetts with these resources of so many TBIs in the New England area, really, teachers for vision who are aware and cognizant of CDI and who are working towards, really, they're really champions for how to educate our children with this in mind. It's really important to get PT specialists. Some of our children who have visual field loss, for, you know, would benefit from orientation mobility specialists. And then input from our multidisciplinary team. What does neurology say? What does genetics say? We in the ophthalmology office do not have a formal tool to assess for CDI. There are a number of tools that can be administered. Often they're administered during these functional vision assessments, such as the Roman, the tool made by Christine Roman. There are other tools developed by Gordon Dutton and Ellis Portavis that basically are sort of inventories or checklists that can be administered to say, you know, does your child have these behavioral characteristics, therefore maybe this child has CDI. And these tools are important because they often give information about goals to set. So if your child is in a particular range of CDI, then this translates into a goal for the child. And so I think that as the ophthalmologist, my role again is just only a sliver in this larger scheme of how we need to work together to make the best educational environment for our children to learn. So a little bit about the anatomic basis of CDI, and this is some of the work that Dr. Maribet and Dr. Bauer have championed and Dr. Maribet showed earlier, but let's look at it again. And let's look at it in the context of two children who came to our clinic with CDI. So the first is this wonderful 16-year-old girl whom I've seen for years. And she was premature. She's very high functioning. She's actually hilarious and has actually quite good vision. And has said, you know, nobody understands me at school. They know I can see. They don't understand why I have difficulties with some of the paperwork they give at school. I just can't interpret it. She had some difficulties with graphs and with math. And and interpreting things that were presented on a paper. She was born premature. She had a CP. And her vision, her acuity was quite high. She was 20/50 in the right eye and 20/40 in the left eye. So in some states, she wouldn't qualify for services at all. And she had reduced contrast sensitivity. And these are her visual fields. So for those of you who are not used to looking at complicated visual fields, this is an automated way of looking at visual fields. And so areas that are dark squares are areas where it was difficult for her to see. And so we kind of divide the visual field into the top half, the bottom half, right and left. And so in general, you can see that the bottom half of her visual field was diminished. And her optic nerves looked a little bit pale. You really couldn't get that much information on the basis of the eye exam, you know, how this would translate into her function. Case two is a 22-year-old man who presented to Perkins. He has significant cognitive delay. He has visual inattentiveness. He, has classic features. He has difficulty identifying objects in a crowded scene. He was also born premature, and he has CP. His vision was more impaired, 20/100. And he also has these characteristic visual fields. So this is a different method of testing visual fields, but the idea is the same. So you can see area where sort of these lines are supposed to be kind of a full oval. This is completely up. So he also has inferior field loss in both eyes. So Dr. Maribeth and Dr. Bauer, Dr. Maribeth already spoke about this, looking into how do we understand this? What is the difference in kind of anatomically, anatomy of the brains that might give us more information about how they process visual information differently from someone who has sort of normal sight? And did a study with collaborating with us, looking at the connections between the visual cortex and these higher order processing centers that we were talking about earlier. Basically, the connections between the vision center and all the dorsal stream connections, and the vision center and all the ventral stream connections. So these are some of the images. So on the left is healthy brain. And this is our young 16-year-old girl and our young man. And basically, it points to that there are some differences on the MRI. But from these differences alone in the visual pathways, we really don't get that much information about how do we predict what their vision function is going to be. So based on Dr. Maribeth's work, and he showed this just now, they found that the connections between the vision center and these processing centers, those connections are much less dense. If we say, our hypothesis is that in order for us to have strong processing, we have to have very strong connections. And in this image, strong connections are going to be the thickness of those pathways and the density of those pathways. So if we look at a patient, the control patient, just by kind of the image alone, you can see that the green is really thick and robust. There's a lot of connections between vision, the vision cortex, and the dorsal stream, and vision cortex and the ventral stream. And then in our children who have CGI, you can see that, it's not as thick. It's not like, not as organized as it was in the patient with normal sight. And so we don't have to necessarily completely understand this magnificent work that Dr. Maribeth did in terms of the imaging tool, but what we can see visually, just sort of qualitatively, is that there's really a difference in the architecture, in the organization of what's happening in these association areas. So our 16-year-old took her picture to her teacher, and she's like, see, here it is, this is my brain, and this is why I don't, understand what these things on the grid. So she felt really vindicated, because she could say, look, I can see well, and I'm here, and I'm with it, and I can participate, but there's something different about how I understand this information. You have to recognize that and have empathy for me. And before, I think having even just images like this, her teachers didn't really take it very seriously. So it's funny that, you know, this information, as Dr. Maribet was saying, it's not really just the data. This data informs us, it tells us there's something different about the architecture, and we can learn from that. But it also is helpful, even this study was helpful to our child, so that she could try to explain what was happening to her. She may not have been able to explain, this is dorsal stream, ventral stream, but she can say, look, the architecture is different. There's something different about me, and you have to help me with this. So these studies really kind of raise the point that CBI may in part be related to this abnormal connection between the vision center and these higher order association centers. And so then, the ultimate goal is, can we use this to make an individualized plan towards habilitation for these patients? Can we improve? So if, for example, we saw that, you know, ventral stream for her was totally intact, but it's really dorsal stream. Can we look more specifically at dorsal stream function to develop an individualized education plan for her? So, in my opinion, this is what I perceive my role to be. So, my role is to maximize vision function. You know, basic things, prescribing glasses, prescribing reading glasses, managing strabismus or eye misalignment. Evaluating visual field so that I can let you know, yes, indeed, there's visual field loss. And then my role is also to recognize CBI, because there are too many children who've even passed through the clinic at Children's for years who've gone through without ever a diagnosis of CBI, without ever anyone recognizing that CBI may underlie the visual dysfunction. And this is particularly relevant, again, for those children who have really good visual acuity, because it's pretty easy to come to clinic, and if you do quite well on your visual acuity, you may get the interpretation, everything is good, and I'll see you next year, right? So my role is to recognize, and try to get a little more granular and try to understand how children are functioning. But then, I think my role is also to initiate the appropriate referrals, to get the functional vision assessment, to collaborate with the TBIs, and register with state services. So through the efforts of Dr. Cran and Dr. Maribet, and if I'm missing anyone who was participated in this meeting, the Mass Commission now recognizes CDI as really an independent reason to register a child with the Commission for the Blind. And I think that's a tremendous change in our interpretation of who needs services. And so in Massachusetts, services are no longer simply based on visual acuity or degrees of visual field. But if you believe that a child has functional vision at the level of legal blindness, then this is a reason to register a child for services with the Mass Commission. And I think that's a tremendous change. And really, the Mass Commission has taken a leadership role here, because it just allows us to offer so much more to a larger group of children who need help. So in summary, CDI is a leading cause of childhood blindness in developed countries. And it's not something that's taught to ophthalmologists. So we are trying, we're catching up. And because it's not taught to us, this condition is likely underreported, so much of, I think, our role is to educate our colleagues about the existence of this condition. There are visual and behavioral findings which characterize CDI, and I think it's critical for us to collaborate as a team towards recognizing it and developing a good educational plan for the needs of our kids. And I think this recognition will help us to maximize what services children get and maximize visual function. And so I didn't put my email here, but I'm always happy to receive emails, questions, referrals. I think increasingly our department, I think now there are 16 of us, we talk about it more, we're trying to recognize it, we're trying to be more educated about CDI so that we can help. But I welcome you to contact me directly, and I'm happy to give my email to anyone if you feel that there's a child who needs to have an eye exam by somebody who may understand CDI a little bit better and who may help to guide what services may be necessary. So thanks so much.
If a child that sustains a, for example, a head injury, not a perinatal issue at all, but say a child is hit by a car at age 3, are some of the same issues seen?
I mean, I think it sort of depends on the nature of the injury and the areas that were impacted by the injury, but definitely we would consider head trauma as a potential reason to develop CDI. So I think, if you read texts about CDI, it really focuses on those causes that occur at the time of birth or, you know, in utero or in association with prematurity. But I think that, in my opinion, CDI is more of a broader term that we use when we see that visual function is less than what we expect based on the eye exam. So I think it would be a suitable reason, depending on the nature of the injury, to cause CDI. Because I don't know what else you'd call it.
And although it's different in an adult, for example, who is post-stroke, if the visual acuity is normal or near normal, but yet the person can't see.
Yes.
Is that the same kind of pathology?
I would say it's not just a question of the nature of the injury, but it's also the timing.
Yeah.
So age 2-3, as you demonstrated, that's when things are still kind of transitioning from pediatric to adult. That's kind of a tough case. 6 years, we're kind of clear. 5 years, as we get closer and closer, are we talking about a developing visual system, or are we talking about essentially an adult brain? So 3-4 is kind of a tough sort of transition grade period.
So I think, I see all these colleagues here, so I don't want to, I probably wouldn't characterize what happens to the adult brain. An acquired injury in an adult, I think, would be distinct from what we're really talking about for CDI. But I don't know if you agree.
I would agree with that.
Yes.
You had said that the eye acuity doesn't develop fully until 5 or 6 years of age.
Yes.
Is that physiologically the eye itself? Is it the brain? Is it both of them?
So I think, I was just speaking to that the eye itself doesn't physically, the macula, the 20/20 part of the eye doesn't physically mature until about that age. The optic nerve that sends the visual information gets myelinated to kind of reach its full function about 2, and then the fovea has to fully mature. So this is really about the eye.
So if a child has CDI that's recognized when they're small, if there's early intervention and certain methods are taught as they're growing, will that decrease the intensity of the CDI?
Yes. So I think they would say yes, and I think there are data, there's literature to support that early intervention may change that trajectory. So, I always, and this is why I think getting services early is so important, because the system isn't fully mature. So can we change that pathway that children are on by having early intervention? I think that's really what we hope to do, and by getting our educators involved early on. And I think, Dr. Fazzie has data, there are data from other groups who study CDI that really show that this makes a clear difference in terms of the outcome, in terms of visual development. So it's really important, because the system isn't fully mature. Yes?
How serious is this CDI?
Well, that's a really, that's a great question and a hard question to answer. I think we can think about it in a couple of different ways. I think it's serious because it affects, you know, if we sample in schools for the blind in the United States, the diagnosis of CBI is going to be a large contributor to those children who are in these schools for the blind. So it's a highly prevalent condition. So I think it's serious in this way. It's sort of, there's an urgency to treat it because there's so many children who are affected by it. And then it's serious because I think we don't understand it well enough, and we're maybe missing, we're underreporting, we're missing children who could benefit from early treatment to change the path that they're on, and we're missing. So I think it's a really significant issue.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
Jenna, could I ask you a question? I want to make sure I understood this. You said that based on your examination alone, you don't make the diagnosis of CBI. Did I understand that correctly?
So I think what I'm trying to say is that I don't have a diagnostic test for CBI.
I see.
So I think families have come to me recently and said, you know, we're here because we heard that you can decide if
right.
this is CBI or not.
Right.
And I don't really feel that that's my place. I can certainly collect all the information from the teacher's provision, from neurology, from my examination, from some kind of behavioral questions that we ask and say, this to me is most consistent with CBI, and I feel very comfortable saying that, but we don't have a specific test for CBI. So I think that's really important. So I always say, look, I really want to hear from your teacher for vision. I want to know what they think. Has somebody done, you know, kind of a CBI functional vision assessment? Where CBI ranks are, you know, and I think those inform. But in the end, I guess here I have to give that final
decision.
And yeah, that's a lot to put on my shoulder. but I don't see it as I don't have some magical tool. There's no diagnostic test for it. Yes.
Another question. I have a lot of questions, but this is CBI is not classified as a medical condition. Like, if somebody, let's say a teacher, decided that a child had a heart condition because of the way that the child was acting, a teacher can't just diagnose and say this child has a heart condition. CBI is a medical, it's a medical condition. So how, like, legally or medically, who really is able to determine? Is it
who's the? Here it's the MD. I mean, I have to
okay.
say I think this is
okay.
CBI. But I think my point of view is that I can't do it in a vacuum.
Right.
But
so
it is, yes,
so then maybe a low vision therapist or a TBI or somebody would do the test.
Yes.
And assess. And then have to send the
yes.
child to an actual MD who then diagnoses specifically.
I think that's how it works. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
That's
sometimes
how it works here. You know,
so
we even can, if we could reconfigure how it worked, you know, I think teachers' revision are quite adept at making that diagnosis, but for how it's set up, I have to make, I mean, not me personally, but, you know, an MD has to say, I agree this is CBI, and therefore the child, you know, requires services, but in my opinion, I take into context I ask for what the TBI thinks, and I want to have everybody's input before I make that final diagnosis. Yes.
So I agree with Dr. Hodari that it takes a community to gather all the information and collectively synthesize that information, and as eye care providers, whether an ophthalmologist or an optometrist, yeah, it's our duty to ultimately make that medical diagnosis and then go from there. But to do it in isolation is a next to impossible task, given the dissonance often between acuity and field and how they use what they have. You know, many eye doctors don't have the time or the way to manipulate the environment in the exam room to recreate that stuff, and therefore, the wisdom of the community is really helpful in helping with that diagnosis.
And in order to be registered with MCP, you would have to have a diagnosis from the doctor.
Right, and, okay. And if I might, I think the issue we as eye care providers are facing at the moment here in Massachusetts, you know, is every individual with CVI legally blind? And that's like saying, is every individual with an ocular visual impairment legally blind? And the answer to that question is easily no. And I think in some circumstances, it's hard to really make that differentiation for individuals with CVI. And I actually think that's something we as eye care providers actually here in Massachusetts need to get a handle on. Because it can make for some very uncomfortable conversations. Obviously, we all want to advocate on behalf of our patients, and in some respects, it's easy to say, yep, sure, see you later. But, I mean, it's a label, and it's important, and it has lots of implications, positively and negatively, for the individual and for society. So, I know that's on my to-do list, is to try and get a community consensus around what that really means for CVI here in Massachusetts.
I think it's difficult enough, though, that right now we err on the side of yes. Mm-hmm. You know, because I think parsing to say, you know, well, you see 2040, and this isn't CVI, or it is CVI, it's difficult to do, particularly in the context of clinicians who don't even know about CVI. So we're trying to sort of say, look, let's recognize it first before we then say yes, no, and
you know.
I think we at least need to be on this end first,
but
we recognize it. Yes?
Has there been any work done on, say, possibly glasses that might filter out some colors to give the CVI and visual world that would show them more contrast?
So that's an interesting question. I mean, I may ask Gary to jump in and Rocky, but Dr. Merriman, there are certainly glasses that have different filtering light to try to reduce glare, to try to improve the quality of what we see. But I'm not specifically certain if they're high contrast.
Yeah. So I mean, in individuals with CVI, some might have reduced contrast as well as reduced acuity, or some might have decent acuity, but significantly reduced contrast to go along with some of the other findings that we have, and either functional or discrete findings that we have. But then the question is, how do you leverage that? So if someone has really low contrast, just like if someone has retinitis pigmentosa, night blindness, increased illumination can be helpful. Higher contrast materials, you're not going to put black print on a blue background, for example, right? So some of your tools in your toolbox for how to deal with individuals with reduced contrast can be essentially the same as you would think for someone with CVI. Don't just because you see those three letters doesn't mean you throw out everything else you knew about how to manage the situation. Look at what's diminished and what's in your toolbox to enhance it. So I think that's really the best way to look at it. In some cases, filters can help. In other cases, it's illumination. And in other cases, it's the correct use of color or contrast, if you will. Light shades against dark shades. Keep in mind that color vision can be impacted in individuals with CVI as well. So it's not just simply the dark red and green, but rather the contrast between. So maybe the light shape on a paint chip versus the very rich shape on a paint chip could be how you manage contrast rather than dense color contrast.
Thank you.
I think we have time for one more question. Yes.
I was wondering if there's ever been any attempts or if there are any now to make like a clinical diagnostic tool for CVI, and do you even think that it's possible to create something like that?
Yeah, so I think there are kind of a number of different avenues that people are taking to address this. So I alluded to this work with Dr. Fulton looking at this difference between BEP, which is really looking at how much vision it's getting through the vision cortex, and PLT, which is how much vision it's getting through the visual cortex and then the output. and whether if we look at CDI, group of children with CDI, can we really define that there are certain disparities that say, you know, that's a signature of CDI, and then relate that difference between those two metrics to CDI diagnostic tool and say, okay, well, it's a difference of 3 octaves visually between the BLP and DEP. That usually is associated with the CDI range of 1 to 2, you know, that kind of thing. So I, for us, it's something that I'm interested in doing and looking at from the tools that I have as an ophthalmologist. But definitely, so I think, so that we could better be able to diagnose in the eye clinic. But also, you know, Ellen from Perkins, in collaboration with her colleagues, has tried to work on parsing down some of the tools that are used for functional vision assessments and see if we can implement those in the eye clinic as well. Some of the kind of behavioral assessments to say, okay, well, I don't have time to do, you know, 60 questions, but maybe there are 10 that are really relevant for CDI that I can administer during the eye test, you know, the eye examination, and say, this seems more likely to be CDI. So we're definitely working on it. And again, we have a very rich community of collaborators, all of whom are working on these tools, and probably talk about some of the other things you're working on.
No, I'll just add that I completely agree that that's a major, major milestone that has to be met, and I think part of the problem is coming to consensus, like what are the 10 factors that you need, for example. So, and I think that's part of the problem. People have been very much in their own kind of silos, doing their own thing. People have their own sort of interest in what they think. Is it visual function? Is it functional vision? Should we be looking at color? Should we look at acuity? Should we look at other aspects? Should we essentially just put that to side and rethink this more from an educational standpoint? And I think that's been one of the biggest barriers. I think we recognize that this is important, but coming together to determine what those factors that need to be measured and how to measure has been a real challenge.
And I think we're working on it. I mean, definitely we're actively thinking about it. How can we leverage tools in the eye clinic that, from my perspective, might be helpful that I can do to say, okay, now this looks like CDI, and then in collaboration with my colleagues to say, okay, this is CDI on the basis of this metric and these other tests. So we're working on it.
Can I just follow up on one thing? So I think what Dr. Marabet presented this morning is an example of, you know, like the toy box test, for example, that they did with virtual reality. Here, the only way that we have some sense of complexity being an issue is through questioning, and perhaps if you actually have a small toy box in your office or have different kinds of puzzles and things that you sort of creatively come up with in your office, those are the only ways you can do that. Here, he took complexity, which we would describe as a functional vision complaint, and you saw the graph, and there's a slope there that's different for individuals with CDI than visual normals, and/or ocular visual impairment. So with tools like that, as they go from the lab to the clinician's hands, I think that they'll be, aside from questioning, there'll be other tools that we can use to make a diagnosis a little more quickly and completely.
One more, it's 11:01, so if anyone has to go.
Okay, so my question is, in both this morning's presentation and in your presentation, part of what both of you presented were MRI images. And so is that the case that the MRI images are always showing what you guys showed or not? Because if so, then wouldn't that be a tool? But yes, so maybe it's not, and I'm not understanding that it's not always the case that you're going to have these ventricles that are going to look a certain way or enlarge or not.
So I think that's a great question. So often the MRI is totally normal.
Okay.
And in these children, they were both premature, and so often they have kind of a very specific injury to the vision pathway that's associated with their prematurity. So here we're just showing that, you know, we get a hint that something's wrong in the MRI, but often the MRI is completely normal. So it's a good question, and I think actually Dr. Bauer, who's not here today, is looking at, are there things in the MRI that we don't look at that might be valuable, maybe the volume of the difference, you know, things that we haven't looked at quite yet. And then Dr. Maribeth's study, looking at the pathways, is not something that we can routinely do. So it's a research-based tool that we look at the vision pathways that we can say this is CVI. But in the general MRI, we can't look at that. But it's definitely a direction. Thank you, everybody.